Hi there. Welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I would like to begin today's program with an article which appeared in the March 25th edition of the Wall Street Journal. The title of this article is AI Titans Work Hard to Discourage Working. This article was written for the journal by Jason Riley. All the confident conjecture aside, no one really knows how the revolution in artificial intelligence is going to play out in the coming decades. Is AI more transformative than the internet? Is it more dangerous than nuclear weapons? And is all of this just ignorance-fueled hype? Depends on who you ask. The economy has evolved over the past 200 years from agrarian to industrial and then to service-based. Automation in general has increased productivity, and technological advances have made workers more efficient and societies much wealthier. Weavers and bank tellers feared for their livelihoods at the time, but the Industrial Revolution led to significantly more hiring in the textile sector, and banks increased employment after ATMs were introduced. We're still waiting for the 15-hour work week and for people to start retiring by age 40, thanks to the proliferation of computers, as some predicted back in the 1970s. The rise of artificial intelligence has initiated the latest round of anxiety that workers might be supplanted by machines. Dario Amodei, who is a co-founder of the AI company Anthropic, said last year that the advances in artificial intelligence have the potential to replace up to half of the entry-level white-collar workforce and lift the unemployment rate as high as 20% within 5 years. Cancer is cured, the economy grows at 10% a year, the budget is balanced, and 20% of the people don't have jobs, he told Axios. Mr. Amodei, no such talk won't win any popularity contest, which is one reason that so many leading Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, including Tesla's Elon Musk, OpenAI Sam Altman, and Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey, have promoted universal basic income schemes to address concerns that artificial intelligence will replace human workers. The idea behind UBI is to provide a regular, unrestricted cash benefit. Unlike Medicaid or SNAP benefits, which give poor people access to health care and to food, UBI programs allow the recipients to use the money any way they want, and eligibility does not depend on income or employment status. In recent years, more than 150 basic income pilot programs in 35 states have been initiated. One of the pilots, backed by Mr. Altman, began in 2020 and provided low-income participants in Texas and Illinois with $1,000 a month, while a control group received $50 a month. After 3 years of payments, researchers found that both groups worked slightly more, which may have resulted from the pilots starting during the pandemic and ending as the economy was bouncing back. But they also found that people who received the $1,000 put in fewer hours on the job than the people who received $50, suggesting that the higher payments provided a disincentive to work. Last month, economists Kevin Corinth and Hannah Mayhew of the American Enterprise Institute released a survey of 122 basic income pilots that took place between 2017 and 2025 in 33 states and the District of Columbia. They reported mixed results. Employment increased in some programs and decreased in others, and the role of the pandemic was difficult to assess. The pilot programs varied in their designs, data collection, and study quality, and only 30 of them provided employment outcomes. Hence, the authors counsel against sweeping policy conclusions based on the results. Most experiments were small, and the evaluations rely exclusively on survey data and thus are subject to reporting bias and non-response bias. Yet, Mr. Corinth and Ms. Mayhew did find that the larger and more credible studies, such as the one Mr. Altman backed, showed that unearned income has a negative impact on a person's willingness to work. Whatever changes AI has in store for the labor force, it won't change human nature. Giving people money whether they're working or not is unlikely to increase the number of workers or to make them more productive. President Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty back in 1964 launched the modern social safety net that a basic income guarantee would expand. What followed were decades of well-intentioned but disastrous wealth redistribution programs promoted by people who believed that divorcing work from pay had no significant downside. They were wrong. The welfare system attempted to replace family breadwinners, but it turned out that those breadwinners were providing more than money. The result of these government interventions was more broken homes, antisocial behavior, and blighted neighborhoods. Programs designed to help people get back on their feet instead became a multi-generational trap. Tech billionaires looking to burnish their image seem to believe that the work ethic is an expendable feature of a free market society. It isn't. If basic income advocates succeed, one of artificial intelligence's legacies might be forcing future generations to learn these painful lessons all over again. The next article that I would like to read for you today was taken from the February 5th issue of the Wall Street Journal. The title of this is, How to Stay Sane in the Race to Burnish Your Artificial Intelligence Skills. Be strategic, not frantic, when looking for artificial intelligence training programs. This article was written for the journal by Callum Borchers. A recent software stock sell-off felt like the latest reason to reach for the career panic button, unless you happen to be an artificial intelligence developer. Investors are dumping shares of software companies whose products seem increasingly vulnerable to artificial intelligence disruption. You don't need to be an economist to understand what the market thinks about the job security of people who work for these businesses. After President Trump said his pick for Federal Reserve Chair was Kevin Warsh, whose preference for low interest rates was partly based on a belief that AI would be a deflationary force, lower borrowing costs and relief from recent price increases sounded nice, but let's be clear. The deflation theory hinges on artificial intelligence's making and putting others making some employers more productive and putting others out of work. It all feeds a sense that you need to become an AI pro, like yesterday. AI adoption is now the top concern for job seekers, according to a new poll by career site Indeed. Burnout was the long-running number one worry in previous surveys, but you can't get burned out of a job if you don't get automated out first. Professional development programs to address AI fears abound, and it's hard to tell which ones are worth your time and money. The answer is not many, not if your primary goal is to add a standout line to your resume, anyway. Given how new and wide-ranging the AI field is, formal training programs and certifications on their own will rarely impress employers today, said Simon Key, Vice President of Client Services and Delivery at the Brixton Group recruiting firm. Rather than let AI panic thrust you into wasted effort, do these few things instead. First, take a deep breath. Priya Rathod, Indeed's workplace trends editor, hit me with a surprising stat that recently. Only 4% of job postings on the platform mention artificial intelligence, despite job seekers' concerns on this front. A couple of caveats are in order. Indeed includes all sorts of jobs, and this overall figure is surely dragged down by listings for baristas and bus drivers. But if you're hunting for white-collar roles, you're more likely to encounter AI skills requirements, and there are probably positions out there where AI would appear in the descriptions, except the jobs have been eliminated and therefore aren't even posted. Still, we should take comfort, or at least a deep breath, recognizing that relatively few job openings explicitly call for AI know-how. It simply isn't true that you cannot land a job without mastering Claude or ChatGPT. So here's the bottom line. AI upskilling, this term intimidating more than it actually is, Rathod says. And there's the right training. So don't freak out, but don't be naive either. Many of us are going to have to become more comfortable with artificial intelligence tools sooner or later to keep up with our peers. The tricky thing is that artificial intelligence training programs are like exercise regimens. Pick the wrong one and it'll let you down harder than a fitness resolution in February. One way to determine what you need to learn about AI is to ask AI. As an experiment, I prompted Gemini to design an AI course for a handsome and sophisticated Wall Street Journal columnist. Gemini disregarded my self-described appearance and suggested a 5-part masterclass in applying artificial intelligence to my elite journalism. I'll settle for a half compliment. The trouble is the proposed course of study wasn't tailored to what I do. It called for lessons on using artificial intelligence to comb earnings call transcripts and catch deepfake videos in breaking news situations. These could be valuable to some of my colleagues, but aren't especially relevant to me. It's true that the value of artificial intelligence training depends on the fit, says Craig Paglieri, who is chief executive of Randstad Digital, the technology arm of the world's largest staffing agency by revenue. My advice would be to ensure the substance and focus are on what you're trying to do in your career, he says. Something more general is probably going to be limited in the impact it has. So I went back to Gemini and told it my column is about career and workplace trends. I also put a 10-hour time cap on the course as a way of forcing the bot to prioritize. The result was more concrete and more on point. It included learning how to speed up tasks such as perusing Glassdoor, where people post most about their jobs, and suggested the best artificial intelligence tool for each purpose. When AI evangelists preach the importance of prompt engineering, this is what they're talking about. Sometimes you have to ask for increasing specificity when the question is, what should I learn about AI to do my job better? And finally, get your story straight. When you find and finish the right course, you're going to feel justifiably proud. Just understand that earning an AI certificate doesn't necessarily make companies see you as a whiz anymore, then completing a brief workout program makes you look like the rock. Recruiters and hiring managers say that they don't know how much stock to put into a credential form. Any of the innumerable online courses out there, and that is why it is essential to articulate with evidence how AI skills can improve your job performance. You're going to have to actually have a portfolio of work that you've produced utilizing AI, says Scott Pulsifer, who is president of Western Governors University, which offers AI certificate courses that include capstone projects. AI training might not be a gold star that lands you a job, but it is something that you can work into your narrative. Frame it as proof that you are the kind of person who keeps on learning, not someone who already knows a whole lot about it. Callum Borchers also wrote the following article that I would like to read, which also appeared in a recent Wall Street Journal. It's too early to write off college degrees, workers find. While skills-based hiring was trendy, companies are now favoring multi-tool graduates. Skills-based hiring was one of the biggest buzzwords of the post-pandemic job boom. It dangled the promise of a major shift in white-collar recruiting. Companies would stop fixating on traditional credentials, such as college degrees and years of experience, and bring in anyone able to perform the duties of open roles. Today, this egalitarian style of idea is a fad that is going out of style. In a fast-changing economy, businesses are automating some entry-level roles and excising middle layers of their org charts. The result is companies that once struggled to fill desk jobs now have their pick of available talent, and they're picking according to familiar criteria. Yes, these changes also have contributed to renewed interest in the trades, but even amid something of a renaissance, blue-collar workers are just 27% of the U.S. workforce, according to the Pew Research Center. We can't all be plumbers. We don't all want to be. The majority of us are vying for white-collar jobs, and we face a future where qualification standards are intensifying, not relaxing. The Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce projects 42% of jobs in 2031 are going to require at least a BA or a BS, up from 35% today. Skills-based hiring was trendy at the height of corporate diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Businesses eager to showcase their commitment to DEI advertise their willingness to consider applicants with the right know-how, if not the typical resumes. They did not have much choice in a tight labor market at the time. In early 2023, I asked Johnny C. Taylor, who is chief executive of the Human Resources Group, SHRM, SHRM, whether hiring managers' attitudes had really changed. "I don't buy it," he told me. "What we're going to see is that when there's more supply than demand, employers are going to revert back to the degree as a proxy for smart. A lot of us are working to prevent that, but I think that's realistic." 2.5 years later, this prediction is coming true. So, is debt worthwhile? Toby Markham believed the hiring game had finally swung in his favor. After dropping out of college in 2001, he spent the next couple of decades in a potpourri of roles: produce company account manager, stay-at-home dad, podcast host, manager of an Outback Steakhouse. When tech companies went on a recruiting spree a few years ago, Markham, who is now 48, or was now 48, saw a chance to turn his computer programming hobby into a more lucrative career. He spent $17,000 on an 11-week coding boot camp. He thought employers would be impressed by his skill set and overlook the degree he did not finish and the years of software development experience he did not possess. Things have not worked out that way. He's applied to hundreds of engineering jobs and landed one interview. In hindsight, he thinks he paid too much attention to people questioning the value of a 4-year degree. "That's part of what made me believe in skills-based hiring," says Markham, who is working at a restaurant again while hunting for a tech job. "You see so many people getting degrees and then they never work in that field." There are plenty of reasons out there to think hard about whether college is worthwhile, including the prospect of suffocating debt and the option to learn a trade instead. On the whole, though, people with bachelor's degrees earn considerably more than those without. A new Indeed survey of 10,000 workers found roughly three-quarters of the people whose education ended after high school earn less than $50,000 a year. Only 45% of bachelor's degree holders make less than $50,000. Not the new normal. Some of the disappointment in skills-based hiring stems from unrealistic expectations, says 110 CEO Debbie Dyson. Her group formed in 2020 to help people without 4 years' degrees find jobs at corporate partners such as Cisco and Delta Airlines. The goal at that time was to address a labor shortage, build on the momentum of the Black Lives Matter movement, and to identify positions where a college degree is not necessary. There is this fallacy out there that companies were lowering the bar, she says. In reality, they expected applicants to have the same skills as ever. They just had to look harder than usual and remove some filters to find it. It takes effort to determine whether someone without a degree can handle a job that typically goes to a college graduate. So it's no surprise that businesses are less willing to go to those lengths now. Dyson says internal candidates going for promotions often stand better chances because they've proven themselves. The hill can be steeper for outside applicants. Addison Bellamy is learning this while applying for project management roles. He has years of managerial experience and a couple of certificates earned through Coursera, but companies generally expect college degrees for the positions that he wants. I honestly don't know why there's that requirement, except that it's the norm again, says Bellamy, who is 37. There is this attitude of, well, you have to have a degree to get this role, because that's what the other companies are doing. This feels like whiplash after he climbed the ranks at a COVID testing company during the pandemic, despite having dropped out of college. When that company wound down, former co-workers hired him as a production manager at their construction business. His unfinished degree was no big deal to those who had worked with him, and he got the impression that it wouldn't be a hindrance going forward. Now he's finding that skills-based hiring was a moment in time, not the new normal. Next, I would like to read a question and answer from the Work Friend column from the New York Times of May 3rd. This column was written this time by Max Reed, and this is Foaming at the Mouth Over Public Brushing. A writer wrote this question into the Times. I work at a small library. My coworker has braces, and after eating, she brushes and she flosses using the sink in the break room. I find this gross. Several months went by before she realized her toothpaste was flicking off her electric brush all around the sink. She seems more mindful about cleaning up after herself now, but I still think this is kind of gross. There are 4 single, all-gender restrooms in our library, but she doesn't seem to want to use them. There is also a sink in the lactation room, which I mentioned to her, but she doesn't seem to use that either. I find this coworker annoying in general, and I realize this might be why I find her toothbrushing in the open so foul. The response to this by Max Reed. I am of the strong opinion that mouths and teeth should remain inconspicuous and unobtrusive in professional contexts outside of their necessary deployment for communication. In public workplaces, people should endeavor to avoid kissing, spitting, lip smacking, whistling, humming, gargling, sloshing, tongue clicking, and yes, brushing or flossing for the sake of professionalism, cleanliness, tranquility, and concentration. This is a personal opinion, not a medical or a scientific one. The truth, though, is that there isn't anything deeply unhygienic or unsanitary about what your coworker is doing. Her mouth bacteria aren't going to survive long on a dry surface, especially when weakened by the antimicrobials found in most toothpastes these days. Provided her foam spit isn't landing in anyone's food, brushing in the break room is perhaps even more sanitary for her than brushing in a bathroom, where aerosolized waste particles might alight on her toothbrush. Should we all be flossing at the break room sink? Well, no. See again my rule about mouths above. But our shared opinion about public flossing is rooted in cultural preferences rather than in any measurable effect on hygiene or on health. And as such, you owe your coworker some grace and patience. She obviously doesn't know it's repellent, which means you may have to be the one to tell her. I gather from your letter, though, that you've mentioned the lactation room sink to her, but it seems clear this mention didn't register as the suggestion or imperative it was intended to be. That means unless you're going to avoid the break room forever or escalate a petty workplace complaint to management, you're going to have to be more direct. I'm going to assume, based on the existence of this letter and the kind of slow-burning resentment it reflects, that you wouldn't feel comfortable simply telling her, "Hey, can you do that in the bathroom? It's revolting." Instead, I might focus on your involuntary response rather than her oblivious behavior and soften the request by acknowledging that in the end, this is about your disgust rather than her inherent grossness. You could say, for example, "This is a weird me thing, but I get sleeved out at the sight of flossing. It's embarrassing to me, I know, but would you mind doing it in the bathroom instead?" No matter how oblivious she is to mores about teeth in the workplace, presumably she has a basic understanding of the social contract, and now that you've escalated your communication from mere mention to direct request, your discomfort and the appropriate solution should be obvious. Just as you have extended some grace and patience to her and alerted her to the ickiness of her behavior to you in a face-saving manner, she now can extend the same grace to you and move the dental care out of your sight. Well, this is all we have time for on our program on careers for today. I hope you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for listening in. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.